from Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, President Obama says it's time to put the government back to work and warns Republicans not to play politics with the debt ceiling.
Let's drop the gimmicks, put aside what's good for any particular party, and let's focus on what's good for the American people.
Also today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears opening arguments in a blockbuster case over money and politics. The European Union wants to spend more money protecting African migrants seeking a new life in Europe. The battle to save lives of premature babies in San Francisco.
Women who have premature labor tend to have premature babies. Premature babies tend to die before their first year.
And the celebrities taking a stand on behalf of the so-called Greenpeace 30. That's ahead on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. We can't make extortion routine. Those were the words of the US president early today. He said he was happy to talk to Republicans, but only once the government shutdown ended and the debt ceiling uncertainty was resolved.
We're not going to pay a ransom for America paying its bills. One of the most valuable things we have is America's creditworthiness. And so when I read people saying, oh, this wouldn't be a big deal, we should test it out. Let's take default out for a spin and see how it rides. Imagine in your private life if you decided, I'm not going to pay my mortgage for a month or two. First of all, you're not saving money by not paying your mortgage. You're just a deadbeat.
The U.S. could default on its debt obligations as early as October 22nd, according to a revised estimate by the Bipartisan Policy Center. That may give the U.S. Congress a few more days to address the continuing political stalemate over the government shutdown and debt ceiling. Priscilla Huff has an update.
No one can predict with absolute certainty the date and time when the U.S. Treasury will run out of cash on hand. But the Bipartisan Policy Center thinks the Obama administration has a few more days to address the debt ceiling. That's the limit on government borrowing authority. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew is sticking to his timeline of October 17th. But the think tank, which follows federal budget issues closely, thinks October 22nd is the likely date Washington could default on its obligations, and no later than November 1st. That's because on that date, huge sums are due for payments on so-called entitlements, $58 billion U.S. total for Social Security retirement checks and other required payments. There has been no movement on Capitol Hill. A spokesman for Speaker Boehner says in a telephone call, President Obama reiterated his refusal to negotiate on a government funding bill or a debt limit increase. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
Two European scientists have won the Nobel Prize in Physics for their work on discovering the theory of the Higgs boson. Peter Higgs from the UK and François Englert from Belgium will share the prize after discovering a particle which explains more about the building blocks of the universe. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has more.
In the 1960s, Mr. Higgs and Mr. Englert were among several physicists who proposed a mechanism to explain why basic building blocks of the universe have mass. Decades later, their theory was proven in 2012 at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland. 84-year-old Professor Higgs, who is renowned for shying away from the limelight, is on holiday and couldn't be contacted for his reaction. But in a statement released from Edinburgh University, where he lectures, he said he was overwhelmed and also congratulated his family, friends and colleagues for their help. Mr. Englert, who's 80, said he was very happy to receive the honour. Dan Whitehead, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The UN Secretary-General has proposed a 100-person force to oversee the destruction of Syria's chemical stockpile over the next 9 months. In a letter to the 15 Security Council members, Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon wrote the role of UN member states will be critical. From United Nations headquarters in New York, Stephen Fee has this report.
Secretary Ban is calling for a joint mission with a light footprint, likely based in Cyprus, considering the dire security situation on the ground in Syria. The enlarged team would operate jointly with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and would be guided by a civilian special coordinator. A Security Council resolution has called on Syria to destroy its toxic arsenal by June 2014. Secretary Bond conceded the final destruction will be the most difficult and challenging phase. Syria is believed to have 1,000 metric tons of chemical agents and precursors, both dangerous to handle and destroy. The Security Council is set to consider Secretary Bond's proposal on Thursday. Stephen Fee, New York.
Italian authorities believe they found a missing victim of the 2012 Costa Concordia shipwreck. The body, thought to be that of Russell Rebello, was discovered by scuba divers near the third deck of the cruise ship. Rome-based journalist Josephine McKenna says the recovery effort is nearly over.
Authorities believe that the body that was found today is the body of Indian crew member Russell Rebello. He and another Italian passenger, Maria Grazia Tricarichi, are the two remaining victims who have not been found since the disaster happened. This news is going to be a great relief for his family, particularly his brother, Kevin Rebello. And he said quite recently that his family just wants a body that they can bury. They want a tomb, somewhere they can go and honour his memory.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The entire basis of the Republican strategy is we're going to shut down the government or cause economic chaos if we don't get 100% of what we want. So my suggestion to the Speaker has been and will continue to be, let's stop the excuses. Let's take a vote in the House. Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
President Obama telling reporters at the White House that, as he put it, extortion cannot become a continuing part of the American political process. He reiterated his willingness to negotiate with the Republicans over all aspects of the country's budget, but only after the House votes on a no-strings-attached spending bill that would put the government back to work. He also warned against the global economic dangers of playing politics with America's debt ceiling. Joining me now in the studio is FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddock. And Lorna, the president almost seemed to concede in that presentation that his position over the last week hasn't changed. This standoff remains a standoff.
That's right, Simon. In fact, he even used those words. He said, my position hasn't changed on this. He's dug in on his side. Speaker Boehner and the Republicans, meanwhile, very much seem to be dug in on theirs. He's still saying he needs a straightforward, no strings attached vote, as you said. Only then can negotiations begin on a range of things, including, of course, that controversial Affordable Care Act, which is what has pushed the Republicans in the first place. And it is still ideologically driven Republicans in the House of Representatives who are saying, no way, they're going to keep the government shut down until the Affordable Care Act is defunded or damaged in some way.
The timing of this appearance in the White House, it came exactly a week after the shutdown in essence began. Presumably there was something psychological in that on the part of the president.
Indeed, we are a week into this impasse now and it doesn't seem as though there's an end in sight. But it also brings into focus a new aspect. Mr. Obama looking ahead to the next forthcoming crisis, that is the need to raise the so-called debt ceiling so the US can make good on its international financial commitments. That's something Mr. Obama acknowledged. Leading economists have already been warning about. They're saying it could be disastrous. He even quoted the Wall Street guru Warren Buffett, who said this could be something of a nuclear bomb for the US economy. Mr. Obama reminded people of the international consequences last time the US got even close to defaulting on its international commitments. He recalled the turmoil on the markets, a downgrading of the US credit rating. That's not something he says he wants to happen again.
Now, of course, President Obama wasn't the only person in Washington today expressing concern about the impact of a failure to raise the debt ceiling. So was Olivier Blanchard, the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, unveiling the fund's world economic outlook this morning. Let's take a listen to that.
If the debt ceiling is not lifted, then there's a direct effect on government spending, which would have to be cut quite dramatically. So just the mechanical effects of that, if it lasted for some time, would be very, very large. Then in addition, it would probably lead to a lot of financial turmoil.
Now, Lorna, you were down there for that press conference at the International Monetary Fund, and that warning really overshadowed the presentation of the fund's economic projections for next year.
That's right, it certainly did. And the focus really was on the shutdown and the debt ceiling. But Mr. Blanchard also said people shouldn't forget the sequester. That's the automatic series of US budget cuts that came in earlier this this year. He said that's led to a fiscal consolidation that's already too large and too arbitrary, and the shutdown is merely adding to those woes. But of course, the debt ceiling really the main concern here. If Congress does fail to increase the amount that the country can borrow to pay for things, the Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, has said that has to happen around the 17th of October, sort of mid-October. And that's really what was the main concern for Mr. Blanchard. He made it clear that that could have major international economic consequences.
And that's now both the IMF and the World Bank, in essence, pleading with politicians in Washington to get this impasse resolved.
That's right. Some very powerful institutions now attempting to persuade Congress. I should make it clear, though, that the World Bank and the IMF did suggest that they don't see it as a possibility that the debt ceiling won't be raised. They called it a tail risk with low probability. That could be perhaps something of a shot across the bows, a warning of what could happen if they don't do what's recommended. But by saying it's a low risk, they're perhaps pushing Congress into acting in time.
FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddock, and you can follow her on Twitter at Lorna Shaddock. European Commission officials say they want the European Union to launch a Mediterranean-wide search and rescue mission to cope with the flood of migrants into Europe. The proposal follows last week's tragedy in which hundreds of refugees died after a boat sank off the Sicilian island of Lampedusa. The EU's Home Affairs Commissioner is expected to ask for the EU's border agency, Frontex, to have its budget increased and its role expanded. For more details, Kevin McAlee spoke to our Rome correspondent, Josephine McKenna.
Italy wants the European Union to adopt an action plan to help all the countries in the Mediterranean cope with this massive flow of migrants. And it's looking to the Commission to support it. It seems to have that support. And Cecilia Malmström was presenting her plan to EU ministers in Luxembourg on Tuesday.
What exactly is in place at the moment, and how will these measures be expanded in that area for this task?
Well, it seems that it's a very ad hoc arrangement at the moment, where Italy is at the front line. Lampedusa is very close to North Africa. It's closer to North Africa than it is to the Italian mainland. And the Italians have been complaining for some time that it's on the front line. It has to accept these hundreds, even thousands of migrants that we've seen in a constant stream in the last few months. There is some support from Frontex, the EU border agency, but this is something that both Italy and the Home Affairs Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, wants to see beefed up. They want to see greater patrols. They want to see more boats out on the water. And they want to see the EU helping Italy to save human lives.
Staying in Lampedusa, there's also been reports of protests involving migrants. What can you tell us about that?
Angry migrants at one of the reception centres, the main reception centre on the island of Lampedusa, held a protest against their conditions on Tuesday. Migrants threw their mattresses outside their rooms, tried to block buses as they were trying to leave. They're very angry about the cramped conditions. This is a centre that is designed to hold around 850 people. There are several hundred more there at the moment. And one of the insiders said today that they were sick and tired of being treated like animals. Security forces were present to try and stop any chaos from escalating into violence, but tension's high. And the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, also attacked conditions at the centre. The UNHCR has made three demands. They want to see this centre immediately renovated. They want to see migrants transferred to other centres within 48 hours of their arrival. And they want a stronger network of migrant centres across Italy. They want to see those centres strengthened and maintained in a way that can handle this incredible inflow of migrants that we've been seeing.
Reporter Josephine McKenna on the line today from Rome. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States heard a potentially blockbuster case on Tuesday morning that analysts are calling the next Citizens United because of its potential to strip away some of the few remaining limits on big money in politics. The case is called McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. A wealthy donor and the Republican National Committee are challenging the limit of $123,200 that an individual can give to various candidates during a two-year election cycle. They claim the limit is a restriction on free speech and free association rights, but the government and watchdog groups argued today that it's a vital protection against corruption. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Alstein was at the Supreme Court this morning and brings us this report.
After hearing the case of Alabama Republican businessman Sean McCutcheon, who wants to donate more than is legally allowed to a variety of candidates, political parties, and committees, some Supreme Court justices seemed inclined to take his side. Justice Antonin Scalia said it's not constitutional for a law to restrict anyone's free speech, and he believes donating money is free speech, even if that law only impacts 1% of the population. Scalia and the court's conservative wing also argued that since they struck down limits on outside spending in the 2010 Citizens United decision, it made no sense to uphold limits on aggregate donations. They said you couldn't call one speech and the other corruption. McCutcheon's attorney Erin Murphy agreed. Speaking outside the court just after the argument, she told reporters that the current system pushes the wealthy to give their unlimited donations to outside super PACs, where there is less regulation.
And as we told the court, in a system like this one, where people are allowed to make unlimited independent expenditures, it just doesn't make sense to continue to have these aggregate limits on how much people can contribute in the most transparent ways possible, which is to the candidates and to the parties and to the PACs.
But the court has held for more than four decades that there is a fundamental difference between unlimited outside spending and unlimited direct donations, ruling that the latter has too great a risk of corruption. Justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan emphasize that big donors usually want something in return from politicians, and upping the dollar amount would give them, in Kagan's words, a very special place at the table. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg added Tuesday that limiting donations actually promotes Democratic participation because it forces candidates to campaign and raise money from a broader swath of their constituents instead of just catering to a few rich individuals. Several groups filing amicus briefs for this case, including Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, the Communications Workers of America, and the NAACP, argued that too few people already have too much influence in U.S. elections. Attorney Liz Kennedy wrote a brief for the policy think tank Demos.
We currently see, according to Sunlight Foundation, 84% of the candidates elected to Congress last year raised more money from the 1% of the 1% than from all of their small donors combined.
Kennedy added that just a few hundred people came anywhere near the campaign contribution limits in the last election, and said the interests of McCutcheon and that tiny fraction of the population don't outweigh the interests of the rest of the population, which would have their political influence drowned out by this potential wave of money. Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP, shared similar concerns.
When we look at equal justice under the law in all of its majesty wants to ensure constitutionally that the homeless person has as much free speech as the wealthy person. This McCutcheon case would undermine that.
If the Supreme Court rules for McCutcheon, individuals will be able to give up to $3.6 million per election cycle. The nearly 100 demonstrators who gathered outside the Supreme Court Tuesday said they were worried by that prospect and pledged to keep protesting for more transparency, more limits on money in politics, and a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, the FBI, with its long arm, may not necessarily be the kind of security agency that many Americans think should be emulated around the world. But in Britain today, people woke up to newspaper headlines announcing that the country has a new anti-crime agency that's widely being described as Britain's version of the FBI. The new National Crime Agency will focus on issues including border security, economic crime, child protection, and cybercrime, and it replaces a much criticised former agency. With a significant proportion of organised crime in Britain committed by foreign nationals and often by gangs based overseas, the NCA is looking to boost its relationships with security services from West Africa to Southeast Asia. FSN's London correspondent Ollie Barrett talked to David Armand, the NCA's head of border policing and international operations, and started by asking him how he feels about the comparison with the FBI.
I don't find it particularly useful because the agency that we're establishing will be very British in its approach. That's not to say that the FBI is a fantastically successful organisation internationally and within the US, but we take a slightly different approach. So I don't think that's a useful comparison. But what we're actually doing, I guess, is taking on a much broader set of responsibilities than the precursor agencies within the UK.
Where are your particular priorities of gaps that need filling internationally?
Well, OK, we've inherited a network of about 120 staff from the UK who are law enforcement specialists who work from our embassies and high commissions around the world with host nation knowledge and authority, to the benefit of ourselves, of course, but also to the nation with whom we're working. But because of that broader responsibility, we're reviewing, and there are other locations around the world now where we'll be seeking to deploy officers. The whole of West Africa will require investment for us to help them to deal with the problems that they face.
What about Southeast Asia? Vietnam again gets mentioned.
Yeah, well, Vietnam, we're developing our capability there. Obviously, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, those kinds of locations. Also, incidentally, some countries in Africa are places where Western tourists travel for the purposes of exploiting children. And those are areas of work that we are working with local authorities to try and combat.
Finally, if you watch any television program or film based in America, you seem to have this FBI guy arriving and then the local police force are furious. And how do we avoid that kind of tension with the NCA and local police forces around the country?
The National Crime Agency is not the same as an American law enforcement agency. There are different methodologies of working. Serious organised crime is a truly global threat that affects our economic systems and our countries, but it also has a real effect on the streets where our populations live, in our towns and cities. And it's in the interests, and it is the responsibility of local police chiefs and crime commissioners to deal with that threat as it impacts on their local community.
This is FSN Reports. Having a baby in the United States is not only costly, it can also be risky. Members of the African American community in particular suffer from disproportionately high rates of infant mortality. In California, home to the US's largest African American population, there have been promising gains tackling the problem through aggressive community outreach programs. But that's not the case in the city of San Francisco, where many African American babies are still being born prematurely, decreasing their chances of survival. From FSN's bureau in the city, Rebecca Bowring reports.
37-year-old Angela Jefferson is homeless and heavily pregnant with a baby girl. She's been living in a room in a women's shelter. She already has two children, aged 16 and 8. During this pregnancy, Angela says she's been more acutely aware of the health of her unborn child.
A couple of ladies I got to know, babies had low heart rates, they were hospitalized. Some people, babies were 5 pounds, so I'm constantly asking my doctor, is the baby more than 6 pounds?
Angela's diligently attended prenatal and parenting classes and picked up some useful tips.
Not missing your appointments and eating healthy and making sure that your whole little attitude is just strictly on your body, your baby, and nothing but healthiness.
An alarming number of African American women are not giving birth to healthy babies. For decades, they've experienced the US's highest rate of infant mortality, nationally twice that of white women. In San Francisco, African-American mothers are six times more likely to lose their babies before the age of one. The problem transcends socioeconomic status and affects second-generation immigrants born and raised in the U.S. rather than recent arrivals. Jackie Copeland Carson is the executive director of the African Women's Development Fund, USA.
The latest research suggests that it is the hormonal effect of institutionalized racism over a lifetime and generations, which is actually causing African-American women to go into labor early. Women who have premature labor tend to have premature babies. Premature babies tend to die before their first year.
This summer, women's health groups brought the issue to light at the Bay Area's annual health walk. Four generations of ladies from one family took part. They're from a county across the San Francisco Bay where black infant deaths are on the decline. Grandmother Gail Hall says her daughter learned what to do to improve her child's chances of survival.
She ate very healthy and wanted to make sure that she did everything right, took her vitamins and exercise so that she was able to bring into this world a good, healthy baby.
Jackie Copeland Carson believes raising awareness in affected communities is essential to solving the black infant mortality crisis.
Now we have all this ethnic diversity in black communities and not a lot of forums for people to get together to highlight the health challenges that we share and that we establish systems of accountability that have women's health and the health of our babies as a priority.
Any new baby's chances of survival in the U.S. are some of the worst in the developed world. Experts say solving the problem doesn't just begin when a woman gets pregnant, but is dependent on her access to quality, respectful health care throughout her lifetime. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Finally today, concerns are growing for the health of some of the 28 Greenpeace activists and two filmmakers arrested by the Russians and awaiting trial on charges of piracy. The head of Greenpeace International says the activists are being held in several different prisons across the northern city of Murmansk. Some are reportedly held in solitary confinement and are enduring conditions of extreme cold. They were detained last month after protesting against oil drilling in the Arctic. And last weekend, protests were held outside a number of Russian diplomatic facilities worldwide, demanding the activists' immediate release. In London, the actors Jude Law, Imelda Staunton and Jim Carter, one of the stars of Downton Abbey, joined the vigil and spoke to reporters.
I'm a friend of Frank, one of the activists who has been incarcerated over there. I'm a friend of their family. And so there's a real personal reason for being here, especially because the conviction that's being threatened is one of piracy, which is ludicrous, seeing as the rig that they were on, they were campaigning on last year and they walked away. And obviously, if it's a rig, it's not a vessel, and if it's not a vessel, then they can't be pirates.
Well, I'm down here to support the Arctic 30, who have been arrested for piracy, which is absolutely ridiculous. That's even the words of Putin. They are not pirates, and yet they've been arrested as pirates. Greenpeace is a globally recognised, peaceful, demonstrated organisation, and yet they've been arrested illegally, I feel, and we must do everything we can to free them.
I mean, there they are, you know, armed with good principles and a banner, sort of trying to pin a banner onto an oil rig in the Arctic, and they're arrested for piracy. It's ludicrous. I mean, oil drilling should be stopped in the Arctic anyway. I mean, there can be no argument that, you know, global warming is damaging the Arctic, and the damage to the Arctic will affect the whole of human life. So there's got to be a moratorium on that. That's got to be stopped. And Greenpeace are drawing attention to this in a very graphic way.
The mellifluous tones of Jim Carter of Downton Abbey fame, bringing the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports to an end. You can get in touch with us by email. Drop us a line at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. Coming up on Wednesday, an interview with the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington alongside producer Kevin McAleese. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.